Welcome back to Innovation. I'm Kara Hetland, and we're broadcasting from the 4850-foot level of the Sanford Underground Research Facility in Lead. And joining me now is Ariel Waldman. She is a NASA advisor, and thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And also a keynote speaker tomorrow for Neutrino Day.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that.
So let's talk a little bit about you. You were an art major. So how do you go from being an art major to an advisor for NASA?
Yeah, it was really unexpected. So I went to art school. I got my degree in graphic design, and I was never really quite a science or space geek. I didn't dislike it, but it wasn't quite on my radar. But I was watching a documentary a few years ago about NASA during the early days, and they were interviewing people from mission control from the 1960s, and they were talking about how when NASA was getting started, they didn't know anything about rockets or orbits or anything like that, and they had to figure it out as they went along. And so I was watching this at home and saying, well, I don't know anything about rockets or orbits or space exploration, and I want to work at NASA. That sounds amazing. So I decided to send someone at NASA that I had never met an email saying that I was a huge fan of their work, and if they ever needed someone like me without any science background, that I was here. And very unexpectedly and serendipitously, I ended up getting a job at NASA from that email, and it just changed my life.
And tell me, what kinds of things do you do there?
So nowadays, I am an advisor to NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts, also known as NIAC, which funds the more science fiction, futuristic, out there sort of technologies that could be transformative to future space missions. So things like using comets as propulsion systems or sending submarines to Saturn's moons to explore the lakes of methane and ethane on Titan, and all sorts of things that are kind of fantastical, but you can do credible research and investigations into them today.
And do you help draw things, or is art just not a part of this anymore?
I think, you know, how it incorporates into my life nowadays is really being a designer, being trained as a designer, really teaches you about communication and about how to communicate effectively and how to translate things. And so I think a lot of my work in trying to get people from different disciplines to come together and collaborate together, being a designer initially really helps with understanding different systems and different ways of thinking about things and how to translate that to other industries and other disciplines. So, you know, how physicists can collaborate with biologists, or how you can get artists collaborating with, you know, any sorts of people, geophysicists and the like.
Okay. And it lets you go and experience really cool things.
Yeah, I get to explore a lot. This year, you know, I'm really excited to be here at the Sanford Lab and actually be exploring this underground laboratory for the first time. It's just really, really cool. That's the only way I can really put it. And then later this year, I'm going on a 64-meter research vessel to explore an underwater volcano and the extreme forms of life around that. That's around a mission from NASA called Subsea, which is collaborating with NOAA, NASA, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. And so that's going to be a lot of fun. And then even later this year, I'll be going to Antarctica to visualize and look at a bunch of the extremophiles that live beneath the ice there.
And then when you see all of this, then what do you do with that information?
It really depends on the project. I think all of my work is motivated by not only making things more open, but by making them accessible. So by making things able so that other people can collaborate. So for instance, when I'm going to Antarctica, I'm going to be doing a lot of microscopy of, you know, nematodes and rotifers and all these little microbes beneath the ice. But all my photos and videos, I'm going to be making Creative Commons license so that they're open for anyone to use. And so that we can have a better understanding kind of worldwide of not only what's down there, but what it looks like and what it moves like, and how the motions of different microbes might be informative about their environments and how they interact in such extreme environments.
So talk a little bit about science hacks.
Yeah, so I am the global director of Science Hack Day, which is a grassroots endeavor to get scientists, designers, developers, and people from all different backgrounds together in the same physical space to see what they can rapidly prototype with science in 24 consecutive hours. And so Science Hack Day is in 29 countries now around the world, and it's just really a heartwarming thing. We get all these different types of people coming together and making weird stuff. And some of that weird stuff, you know, is completely useless, and some of it's really useful. And it's really just about people exploring new things and getting collaborations to happen that otherwise wouldn't happen in person.
And these are not scientists who are doing it.
Scientists are working with non-scientists. So everyone's coming together at the same level. So just as much as people are coming from non-science backgrounds and learning new things about science, we have scientists coming in learning new things about electronics, about design, about a lot of different ways of prototyping things. And so everyone's sort of learning from each other.
Give me a concrete example of a day.
Yeah. At Science Hack Day, you know, people come in, they collaborate, we get people just sort of organically forming teams. One of my all-time favorite hacks that have come out of Science Hack Day was one where someone wanted to create a device that would detect when he needed to shave. It was very odd, but, you know, we let people kind of explore however they want. So this guy took a USB microscope and he held it up to his face, and he got this really gross image of all the stubble on his face, and he wrote some basic computer vision and was able to get it to identify all the lines on his face and tell him when he needed to shave. But watching this hack was a particle physicist. And when the particle physicist saw this, he thought this was a genius way for detecting cosmic rays in cloud chambers. And so following Science Hack Day and following this hack, an entire multi-year student-led research project was created out of, you know, code and computer vision library that was originally used for someone to detect whether or not they needed to shave. And so this is what I really like about Science Hack Day, and really about my own personal mission with science, is really about infusing more serendipity into science.
Hmm. And getting the everyday use part of it to come out too?
Yeah, I think, you know, people are creating all sorts of things. And I think, you know, some of them might be just making processes better for people, you know, so that their work lives are easier. Mm-hmm. And some of it's more, you know, the fantastical side of things. But it's really, I think, without having experimentation, we just don't know what we could create or how much better things could be. So I'm really trying to get people to experiment and play around to see what we can do.
Okay. And your talk tomorrow, what are some of the things that you're going to focus on?
Yeah, so I'll be talking about a lot of different examples of some of this multidisciplinary collaboration, but also about, you know, how anyone can get involved and how there are many different opportunities for people from all different disciplines to get involved in science and space exploration and the impact that it can make.
Okay. And you interview scientists as well? You kind of have a YouTube channel too?
Yes. Yeah. So I've got a YouTube channel under my own name, Ariel Waldman. And I also have a book called What's It Like in Space? Stories from Astronauts Who've Been There. And throughout those, I interview a lot of different experts and talk to people. And for the book, I interviewed a dozen astronauts and went through a lot of historical interviews with astronauts, just understanding what it's like in space, but also, you know, the more kind of funny stories about what it's like in space, the more amusing, embarrassing stories people have about, you know, what it's like to go into space and yet still have a very human experience up there.
They're human? Astronauts are human?
Yeah, I tried to reveal the more human side of, you know, when they get embarrassed or when silly things happen. And, you know, going to space is obviously a serious endeavor, but I think it's also a human endeavor. And so mm-hmm. with that comes, you know, all of the awkwardness of being human. So I really like that.
So taking that example of the astronauts and helping to design, you know, future space travel as an advisor, how do you incorporate the human part of that?
Yeah, it's in a lot of different ways. Certainly with the NIAC program, people can contribute concepts that help with life support. And importantly, with how humans are going to be able to one day explore Mars. So a lot of the technologies that we need to actually explore Mars just simply don't exist yet today. They're possible, but no one's built them yet. And so a lot of life support stuff, a lot of how we're actually going to land humans onto the surface of Mars doesn't quite exist yet. The ways that we've been landing rovers would not be so good for humans, squishy humans who can break easily. So we need a lot of stuff like that, and also in situ resource utilization. So utilizing, the resources that we have available on Mars for support of human life. So there's a lot of things that people can be exploring that really are around human exploration of our solar system.